Hello, and I'm Annika Wills, and I played Polly in Doctor Who in 1966, and you are listening to Gallifrey Public Radio.
This is Gallifrey Public Radio, a weekly podcast dedicated to positive enjoyment of Doctor Who. We travel through classic and new episodes, explore the extended universe, and play a few games from time to time. We do discuss news, content that has been officially released, and the occasional interesting rumor, but we'll warn you before anything considered spoilers comes up.
Welcome to episode 424 of Gallifrey Public Radio, where things start out well enough, the usual amounts of danger and sarcasm, you know, and then, I'm Jay.
I'm Julie.
And I'm Kier. This week, the second season of Torchwood comes to a gut-wrenching close with exit wounds. There is an unlikely villain behind the uncertain villain, and a final act that nobody really saw coming. And now that you've seen it, you gotta wonder whether it was something you wanted to see in the first place. Chris Chibnall at his best, dare say. But that's all I really have to say as far as the top line reaction to it. But I wanted to ask both of you, rather than as we normally do in saying, oh, you know, high altitude, I consider the episode a 7 out of 10 or what have you. Not that we ever actually use that voice. But as far as coming off of the first half of the two-parter, okay, and what that leaves us, that kind of the what happens within the last 30 or 45 seconds of that episode, fragments, what were your early expectations coming into this as far as what you expected to see happen or the sort of the twists and turns that you thought the plot was going to take? I do realize that we forgot a lot about some of these episodes over time, so it's kind of new to us. Sort of. But yeah, as far as early expectations, where did you think the tone and the pace and the general bent of the story was going to take heading into the finale?
It's hard for me to say because I remembered certain things about this episode, not very much now that I've gone back and watched it, but the things I did remember set a very certain tone about what I was expecting. Mm. So it's hard for me to say that, yes, I was expecting this, that, or the other. Trying my best to separate everything, it did seem like the last episode was a heavy hitter. You know, we were in constant danger throughout the whole episode, and so we kind of had that expectation set at a certain point. Coming into this one, there was, you know, that same kind of adrenaline punch, like, okay, things are bad from almost the very beginning, and, you know, the whole city gets blown up, and there's this, that, and the other, and so it kind of had that energy that we wanted from it. And I don't know if the ending kind of fit with everything that went before it, but it certainly left a memory.
Right. Again, it's like, yeah, another one of those Chibnall gives you 95% of a story, sets you up with certain things, and then the last 5% completely turns it on its head. That seems to be one of his favorite writing maneuvers, I guess.
Maneuver. I had completely forgotten the entire episode.
Cool. It's a great way to rewatch television.
I legitimately remembered just that the last 5 minutes happened, but I honestly thought that it happened much earlier, like from the just my memory of it was that's the only thing that happens.
Okay. Oh, so, well, yeah, I get that.
Yeah.
If you're going to forget anything, it's going to be anything but that.
Yeah. Right. So I was kind of waiting for the, like, wait, do they die now? Wait, do they die now? So
the ultimate shoe drop.
Yeah. So I think for me, where I thought a lot of the action was going to happen was very much me sitting on the edge of my seat because I was like, oh no, okay, not yet.
True. All right. Well, there is quite a bit of emotional baggage to unpack for this one. So let's take this in very manageable, emotionally tolerable chunks.
Then I should leave now?
Yeah, no, okay. Yeah. We'll let you know when the conversation's over.
Bastard, John's taking our SUV.
Looks like he's driven it back to Torchwood.
I'm getting readings of rift activity all over the city. Major rift flares at St. Helens Hospital, the police headquarters, and the central IT service station. Hey, Andy!
Gwen, you've got to get here right now. I'm serious, we need you.
Okay, I'm on my way, all right? This is him, isn't it? This Captain John, or whatever he likes to call himself.
Rhys, drop out at the hospital. Tosh, Yanto, cover the central server building. Gwen, the police station. And take me to Torchwood.
You think we're all gonna fit in here?
Yeah, we're gonna have to.
Jack, these are traps.
So be careful, you know what he's capable of.
What about you?
I'm gonna go reason with him.
They just tried to kill us.
I was the only one who could ever control him. That's why the Time Agency partnered us.
Did you just say Time Agency? Don't tell me that's based in Cardiff too.
Okay, so there's initially the, what I'm gonna call it, the dark gray. Realization, because I thought that was funny. That
you should really stop writing these, thinking about these notes. Like,
I do. Well,
free coffee. I don't know.
No. Oh, come on now. I thought that's
no,
pretty,
no, no. It is. It's good. I like it.
So I just kept thinking to myself that as you find with a lot of these shows that have to do with somebody who's been carrying a particular grudge for a while. Or has been stuck in imprisonment, or in this case, torture for so long, and has twisted their mind, right? That of all of the things that he could have fixated on while being tortured by the creatures, we never find out exactly mm-hmm. what they are, just the creatures, that it's Jack's letting go of his hand that is the thing that he latches onto. You know, assuming well, he was a kid, 8 or 9 years old or something like that. Mm-hmm. So maybe his rationale is
you know, I thought he was much younger. I thought it was like 5.
I don't know. Possibly. I don't know. Little kid. Just yeah. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And that's the only thing you know of your family.
Yeah. But of all of the things, rather than pointing the animosity at the captors or anything like that, it's Jack letting go of his hand that is the thing that sets him on this massive arc.
Did he ever say specifically how long he was in captivity? I mean, was it?
No, but assuming that he looks like he's about 20 now.
Yeah, so I mean, it might have been that for.
I think we have to assume that it was long enough that the last time we met John Hart, he had not found him, and mm-hmm. I know that like it's timey wimey, so it is what it is. But I would let that play into the fact that when we see John Hart again now, that it's relatively short in between there. Mm-hmm. And so I think it was Gray as an adult, as he is now, like from when he was 5 to 8 mm-hmm. until he was 18 to 25.
Right.
Is when he's been in captivity.
It's just because it is timey-wimey that I wasn't sure if it was like, oh, he was in captivity for 70 years or something like that. But it's
all right. That leads me exactly to the other side of it. So if it was, as Julie says, if it was whatever, 10 years, 15 years, something like that, that he's been worked over, or at least until such time as he was able to, because at some point he broke free of this and was able to amass his abilities to.
John says that he found Gray. Mm-hmm. Still chained up or wherever.
Yeah. Right.
The only one alive.
Right.
And like that's where he found him. Right. I took it to mean that it wasn't very much time after that from when Gray turned and made him.
Yeah. But it just seems to me like he amassed an awful lot of power.
And knowledge about how to set bombs and take out every bit of Cardiff.
Yeah. If he was only in John's custody for 6 months or whatever, you know, relative time. I just think it was might have been longer. Like it might have been John rescued Gray or found him, you know, freed him from mm-hmm. whatever state he was in, turned him out or sort of let him go, and then Gray gathers all of his ability. And since John was his only point of contact, goes back and says, "I'm going to use that individual of power too, because he has resources that I'm going to manipulate.
Yeah,
it's a lot left open.
I think that's where, for me, that this sticking point is what made this episode, on my second watch or third or however many times this is, once it started to come back, I was like, oh, here are a little bit of those plot point missing bits of information that, because of the, for me, the believability and the jumps between some of that.
Well, it's, I feel like there was a lot that got, that was seeded here that we never, you know, actually got anything paid out on. You know, we never learned anything about the creatures aside from they're terrible. We don't know what they are, what they look like, nothing like that. I feel like that was something that got worked in so that they could pick it up later on if they wanted to. You know, so a lot of the, you know, plot holes or whatever was stuff that they wanted to build on at a later point. So the fact that it didn't all congeal in this episode didn't bother me as much. And, you know, as far as Gray, it was like, it seems like in that kind of situation, I would be willing to bet that he spent the first 5-10 years or whatever kicking himself for like, if only I had kept up. But after a certain point, you've got to stop kicking yourself and you've got to start looking for something else. And that's probably when the switch flipped. And it's like, well, no, Jack had my hand. Why didn't he hold on tighter? And then all of a sudden, instead of being the victim, he had something to keep him driving forward. So
I don't see any reason why the Gray perspective is not believable. Being, even if it was from day one, blaming Jack and him coming back, I 100% agree. That is, it could have gone the other way if that was what we were going for, but this is totally believable and definitely makes it that much more interesting between the last episode and this one, where we've got that, I play this hand, I show you my card of John, and then I show you this card, which is me.
Right. Looking very much like one is a captive of another kind of thing, and turning that around. So there you got the other side of the coin now, which is John trying to explain, trying to carefully say without actually saying, because he's got a bomb fused to his forearm, that, no, I have to do this. I'm obligated to do this. I'm being forced to do this. I know this looks really bad, really, really bad, but I'm doing this because I love you.
Right.
So I do think that this is a very strong episode for John. I mean, I think I like this one better than the what was it? Was it Kiss Kiss Bang Bang? Was the name of the first episode where we meet him? As far as just making him interesting and compelling.
But if we didn't have that previous episode, this one wouldn't.
Oh yeah, this one would fall
play as well, because we wouldn't know what
exactly
what their relationship is.
Yeah,
and I do love the fact that it's, you know, they do play it up to that fact, but it is not unbelievable when you get the reveal that John Hart is being manipulated or being, held captive or whatever. It was like, okay, no, that makes sense. I understand now. Now the whole, like, I love you, remember that while I gun you down. That actually makes a lot of sense. Before it was kind of like a, you know, almost like a Joker level of like, hey, I really love you, but I got to make sure that this is right. And, you know, he guns him down. It was like, okay, it didn't bother me, but it was like kind of a little bit, but it all fit at the end. And I do, I was trying my best to remember, because I was like, I didn't think that John was an actual villain. Like he was a foil for Jack. Yes. But I couldn't remember him actually being a villain. So I was like, man, I didn't remember crap about this episode apparently. And then like halfway through when we get the reveal, it was like, okay, no, it's fantastic. I love this.
Now we get to go back to our character alignment episode and figure out where the heck he fits.
Now I feel justified in saying, I don't think he was the villain. I just didn't remember why I didn't know that.
Yeah.
Because I didn't remember this, but I remember thinking, like, why are you putting him there?
Absolutely fair.
I didn't think he was that bad.
Mm-hmm.
So one of the things that I will give this story a lot of credit for, aside from all the emotional beats that it smashes into, is the fact that Chibnall, as effectively showrunner for this, for all intents and purposes, at least through the second season, or taking that helm for lack of title, really decides to pull a lot of the threads together. character threads, things we've established as far as their relationship, some small things that they've dropped along the way as far as where they stand in a lot of their balance of authority, Gwen's background, or her ongoing relationship with the Cardiff police that is or isn't a position of authority. We're not really sure, but all of a sudden, darn, does she take charge over the entire police department. Julia, I know you had a particular note about our lovely little snarly-faced, bald-headed jumpsuit dudes.
Oh, do you mean the weevils?
I do mean the greater of two weevils.
I love that the weevil story has twisted up into a nice swirly cone of ice cream.
Relevance.
Actual relevance.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, soft serve relevance.
Yes. Between the tones calling them out, the Owen walking through them, and he's, you know,
king of the weevils.
King of the weevils, yeah. And the they each have their own little packet of weevil spray. Like, it just every single moment that there was one more, let's call the weevil. I just love that very much. And I also like them popping out of their holes in the parking decks and things. I just. Mm-hmm. That
they even had the hive where the Jack went to go get the what was the item that he had hidden stashed away there in that previous episode, right? Yeah, the other love glove,
the right hand, if you will.
So, which I guess they probably just used some extra footage. They're like, yeah, we need a footage of all the weevils over in the church popping up.
Remember that 30-second bit we left on the floor? Let's just pick that up and stick it in here.
Waste nothing. That's what you do on a shoestring budget. Yeah.
I think that's the moment at which specifically I said, oh, they're going to wrap all these together.
Yeah.
Because it's pulling all of those different pieces of that. I loved that. I liked seeing the wraparound of how Jack became involved in the early Torchwood days, which we did not know.
That's true.
Yeah.
How do they owe him? They're following him around for a while. You're supposed to work for us. We literally dug you up.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, that's actually one thing I wanted to check with you both. I think we've seen a couple of different science fiction properties that have used the idea of someone who has been buried alive or entombed or something for a long, long time and what it does to them psychologically. This, apparently, Jack is psychologically rock solid because he spends 1,800 years... chewing on dirt and dying over and over and is fine.
But why didn't he just dig himself out?
Slowly earthworm his way out?
Yeah. Like, why is that not an option? Because, yes, he had handcuffs, but it's not like you just shift around for a few years. I mean, like 1 year worth.
That way. Dirt doesn't work that way.
But you start scratching up and then you get... No,
it's called volume displacement. It has to go somewhere.
Yeah, but you scoot it around.
Scoot where? You're buried.
Under you. Like
where the other dirt is.
You become one with the dirt and move upward.
Okay, we're going to do a Mythbusters test. We're going to bury Julie in sand for an hour.
I didn't say me. I just was wondering. I mean, he's been down there a while.
I'll give you a scuba tank.
He only started. That wasn't even a full 6 feet under.
I don't know, but it was a perfectly rectangular hole.
She said it was a 20-foot grave, so it didn't look that deep.
Well, by the time you get to,
Well, yeah.
That's also working against you there. Plate tectonics.
Shovel a bit more on.
2,000 years of...
But I think for what that's worth, I don't think that he would have even tried. I think the whole point was he knew he had penance, and he knew the ring was going to be of some... saving factor, or he would be there forever.
Right.
That we don't know how the mechanics of Jack resurrecting has always been a little bit squidgy. So we don't know. Like maybe he died and then was unconscious for hours or even days at a time, and then he'd only come back for enough time to suffocate again and then die again. So. How much time
in his consciousness? Yeah. Maybe it's only like 90 minutes.
Yeah, exactly.
No, I don't think he's out for that long. I mean, yeah, he's going to asphyxiate every time, but I don't think that takes days. And I think that when he does come back, it's always within hours. when you get
depending on the nature of the depending on how violent or how severe the the method.
But if every time he comes back, it's a big kind of thing, and he can't do that under
there's another breath, and he's back out again. It's a vicious cycle.
He just ate more dirt. That's how he gets. He gets just dirt.
You are going full earthworm with this.
Yeah.
Earthworm Jack.
You can eat
enough. The not popular video game series, Earthworm Jack.
You can eat enough dirt to make your way out. I feel like one bite at a time.
But when he is revived in 18 something or other, by
not that dirty. Doesn't have a beard.
Oh no, he did. He never. Do you ever see Jack shave? You never even see him in 5 o'clock shadow.
I'm just saying.
My point was that he decides rather than just to sit and twiddle his thumbs and avoid himself on his own timeline, he says, "No, put me in cryo that doesn't exist yet."
It's Torchwood. They have all the tools.
Torchwood. It's Torchwood like 1.0. This is like
it's. Honestly, it's probably Jack saying, "I have the knowledge. Here's how to build it. Please make this thing."
Yeah, get a big bucket. Put me in this
cryo. Yeah,
do the ice bucket challenge, Harkness style.
So Jack knows about cryo because Torchwood has cryo, but Torchwood only has cryo because Jack knew about the cryo. And I just broke my brain.
Mm-hmm. Yep, causality loop. There you go. Enjoy it. So this means, though, so Jack makes the decision that he's going to put himself for that last leg of it, that last 200 years. Like, the first 1,800 mm-hmm. years was crap.
Right.
But 200 years, I'm going to take a little rest. I'm just going to chill out for, like, 200 years, pop me out so I can finish this job and do something horrible to my brother. But then he doesn't actually. This is Jack's big heart. He has the opportunity to just say, you know what? You've gone bug nuts. And it's over. He decides, though, that he's going to put Gray in the freezer,
mm-hmm.
which leaves the door open to Gray being utilized another time.
Yeah.
But maybe he'll come back as the White Wizard next time.
Oh, he's going to get really sweet robes. By the way, speaking of robes, I just want to get this thought out because I didn't mention this to you as we were watching this. Gray's outfit through this whole thing, that weird puffy suit thing that looks kind of like a straitjacket but isn't. I am almost certain that is a firefighter's flame retardant undersuit. Seriously.
That makes sense.
Yeah.
I don't know why you'd wear it. It looks kind of weird and like post-apocalyptic.
Well, he found it. You know, he just found it when he
that's the best kind of, you know, it's just ersatz fashion.
I think that Jack's choice to forgive and ice Gray is his only way of. He was never going to kill his brother. He carried around thousands of years, hundreds, thousands of love and worry for his brother. I don't think you can put someone down after all of that time.
Mm.
Even if they just did the most unthinkable.
He does lean into that. He starts that scene. I forgive you. And Grace says, "No, you got this. We're fighting now." And she's like, "Excuse me.
I said, I
forgive you." Like that is like the I said please.
Don't make me count one, two.
Big brother syndrome all over this. Mm-hmm. I love that. It was like it was supposed to be poignant, but it wasn't quite landing right. And to me, in my head, all I heard was, "We're done talking. I said I forgive you. Now go eat your green beans."
Yeah,
I loved it. characters that do not get an opportunity to repeat their statements. And this is where we leap fast forward to our final 10 or 15 minutes or so. I think the coordination of events that gets us to where, you know, the whole nuclear reactor aspect of this mm-hmm. was really well orchestrated. Chibnall really had a nice chessboard going in order to position the right characters in the right places to play to their strengths. Owen being the dead guy who can take the risks, Tosh being the techie who has to figure this stuff out.
Mm-hmm.
But you don't really have the opportunity. I didn't have the opportunity to really appreciate that much on first viewing. I remember looking into my way back machine because of the emotional wave that rolls over this whole thing. It was mm-hmm. easier on subsequent watches, but man, this is like Moffat level mm-hmm. of emotional manipulation.
I think the thing that sticks with me the most is that they died in each other's spaces.
Yeah.
And Tosh dies in the infirmary, and Owen dies in a nuclear power plant behind the panels and controls and can do nothing.
Yeah. I didn't even realize that. Yeah.
Yep.
That's like, really, really poignant.
They danced their twisted dance of can never be together, and then they,
yeah,
within minutes of each other, are just...
Yeah, I vividly remembered the visual of Tosh on the floor in the infirmary. I forgot how Owen went. Like, for some reason in my memory, he was there next to Tosh. But maybe that it was just because that was his space and that's where he was supposed to be. And that's what stuck in my head.
Yeah, yeah.
But no, that visual of her laying on the ground, because it was, you know, Owen was dead and we knew that. And it was just a matter of time as to when his clock got punched, you know. But, you know, that gut shot, and then, you know, she's managing to keep going and things like that. And it dragged on so long that you're like, you're upset because you see the gut shot and you know what that means, but then it just keeps going and she's managing to do all these things and you're like, maybe she'll pull through. And then when Jack and Gwen get there, you're like, okay, sweet, she's saved, and she's not. And it was just, yeah.
Just kept pumping her full of drugs.
Yeah, well, painkillers only. Yeah, so she's not quite aware of it. So at least she goes out sort of passively. I gotta say, to Naoko Mori's credit, of all the various ways you can handle a death scene, and all the different choices based on, you know, is it a violent occurrence? Is it something slow? Is it, you know, is it foreseeable or anything like that? And actors always have to make those choices about how to portray it, down to even what the writing provides you, where I'm sure that there's things in the stage direction that says, you know, character A looks into character B's eyes and drifts into middle distance or what have you. The way she handled it as far as choosing last words, shuddering breaths, all those things felt particularly hard to take because it was true to her as a character. She was not going to be the type to go out whimpering, but she was not the type to go out and saying, and I do it all again, or anything like that. You know, or I'm going to polar extremes on this, but yeah, it's just to make the point that this was Tosh.
Her entire talking Owen through the whole thing, it speaks to all of that as well. She was just the strength behind him, and he didn't even realize it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
He's, especially when he wants to just rage until he's gone, and he asks the question, which I feel like, you know, Owen of before he died the first time wouldn't have asked that question of, well, why shouldn't I? But since he's dead once, he gained a little bit of that insight, and she tells him, you're breaking my heart. And I think that right there to him is just says, like, focus on somebody, not yourself. I'm literally the only person here with you, and they know at this point I've loved you for so long. We never got that date, huh? So just all those heartstrings from both sides, just tears streaming down my face.
Yeah, really, really. This is a Geppetto moment for Chibnall as far as being able to say, I have all of these little pieces that have been established for these characters that I get to pull all these strings at once.
Yeah.
That's extremely effective, which is unusual because we as the audience are smashed with all of this even before some of the full realization or full processing time for our surviving Torchwood team members. So we get to sort of, you know, we're cresting off of that and dealing with an aftermath as it's starting to dawn upon, you know, Gwen and Yanto. Yanto is almost sidelined through this whole thing. Like, he doesn't even have a way to respond, other than just to sort of stand there and be, you know, a point of consolation or somebody for Jack to hug into his therapy triangle.
Well, Jack wasn't going to plug in the details in the computer, so it had to be Owen, or not Owen, Yanto and Gwen doing that. And
always then, has to do the cleanup.
Yeah. But I think the memo from Tosh kind of buttoned it up. And
I was curious about that. I wanted to ask you both about that, about the way that was done. There's a lot of things that could have been put into that sort of a, you know, if thinking one of the weird instances where you might want to leave a posthumous message, and the things expressed. When do you think she recorded this? Where do you think she was in the Tosh timeline when she decided, oh, you know what, I better put something in the system in case my file gets put in as deceased?
In my head, she did this sometime after Susie, when Gwen came on board. Because that probably would have made it real, like, we could actually die on this job, you know? And so I think that's when she probably at least came up with the idea. But that, I mean, it could have been, you know, like her third week on the job, who knows? But for some reason, that's what stuck in my head.
Yeah, I agree. It's got to have been a few years into her working there, but not too close to the end here, because I don't think she's had the first death of Owen where she tells him how she feels.
Right. I think I know exactly why I think so, because she covers herself really quickly when she's addressing Owen directly,
mm-hmm.
and says, I love you. I love all of you. There's like that quick cover.
Yeah.
Well, but right. So it's still young love. Like it hasn't been expressed yet,
mm-hmm.
but she's gotcha.
Right.
But they, and I think before that is when, like, that's around the time I feel like she was the most still very much in love with him before he died the first time.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Around, but maybe after Adam?
I was thinking that, because Adam actually made them sort of, I think, mess with a bunch of things within each of them psychologically that would have changed the way that they communicate with one another, even if they can't remember why it is that they're behaving differently. Yeah.
Yeah. So that's where I place it.
We were discussing Chibnall's utilization of the chess pieces as he had them sort of arranged here. Do you think that to a certain degree, because this is Russell's project, this was his baby, right? His creation and his utilization of characters that were written under his tenure. But Chibnall was holding the reins by the time we close season two. This particular style that he's, or this skill that he's flexing right now with regard to making sure there's a continuity connection. You know, when you get really invested in a show like this, where you have characters that go through these individual and these collective arcs, and they go through these adventures, and there's some things that are left in the periphery. A really, really interesting series, whether it's science fiction or otherwise, and this is me just talking here, I find it particularly engaging when there are continuity connections that say that the showrunner is cognizant of the fact that they have set all of these wheels in motion, and at some point, you want to touch upon those to say, we're still thinking about them too, we as the creators. Mm-hmm. Do you feel that this was Chibnall following Russell's instruction, or that this is him doing something that is sort of unique to the way that he works with his characters? The reason why I ask this is because we are now cognizant of seeing what Chibnall does with a cast of characters like he's doing on Doctor Who proper. So are you seeing some commonality that says, now this is a Chibnall thing, or is this still a Russell property at this point in Torchwood?
I'd like to believe that it's all of them and that they're just very good at their jobs.
Mm.
And when you leave yourself, whatever you want to call them, threads, Easter eggs, gifts for yourself and your writing team and the people who are making this content, that you pick them up as you go and you say, haha, I collected these. And that's what makes you a good writer. That's what, for me, any show that does that is a show that I get to the end and go, huh, I'm going to go back and watch that again.
Right.
So that, to me, is just, I would hope that it's the way that they work.
Indicative of good writing, regardless of
which. Being good at your job.
It does ring familiar, but it's a different flavor in this one than it is with Doctor Who. So I have a feeling that this is something that, you know, maybe it was just Chibnall being around Davies that, you know, he picked up on it. Maybe it was a conscious discussion that they had. Maybe it was, I don't know, but I feel like Davies had an influence on it, and this was Chibnall either modifying that or just trying to emulate or something like that. It was a little bit of both of them, where once we get to, you know, current Doctor Who, Chibnall's, you know, he's done a few things, he's refined it, and now this is, you know, concentrated Chibnall. This is, so,
mm-hmm.
I feel like this was a nice kind of blend of the two of them, whether intentional or not, I don't know, but.
Also go back and see some of the interviews that RTD has done specifically about Torchwood. It's very, very seldom that panel conversations and things like that where people wouldn't just be talking about Doctor Who. I got to see if there's an archive of conversations that he's had specifically about Torchwood and his creative insight on that one. Yeah, for sure. Okay, tough question time. And it's not a question for us. It's a question for anybody who's listening to this right now.
I cast my vote.
All two of you. All right, listener. We...
Parentheses, S parentheses.
Question mark, asterisk. We have ahead of us what is technically the third season of Torchwood. It is a miniseries. It is only four episodes.
Five episodes.
Yeah, five.
The Children of Earth series. Because
it's 5 days.
Right, 5 days. For those who haven't seen it, bless your little white socks. For those of you who have, you, without spoiling anything, you will agree that this is rough television to watch. Thematically, as far as, you know, current relevance, think about everything you remember about this season of Torchwood and think about whether or not it's something that we should include with our Torchwood rewatch. Or do we call it right here and say we covered two seasons and we're done? So how are we going to handle this, Jay?
If this is something that you have been looking forward to us covering, you know, if you want to hear our take on Children of Earth, then let us know either through the email or on any one of our social media accounts or, you know, however you can get your opinion to us. Let us know that this is something you've been looking forward to. If you have no opinion one way or the other, I mean, you can share that opinion too. But
if you just don't want us to watch it, if you understand, if you've seen it and you go, nah, no one has to watch that again because it's so emotional, let us know.
Yeah.
We've had folks who have seen it and want to hear a take on it. There are those who have seen it and do not want to see it again. There are those who haven't seen it and are curious to know why it is considered, you know, such impactful television, which undeniably it is impactful. That is a yes. That is a valid adjective. but then there are those who have not seen it but have heard enough to know, nah, dog, I don't want to have anything to do with this.
If you haven't watched it yet and were waiting for us to do so, go watch it and then see if you really want to hear us talk about it too. Like, that's a valid thing as well. I mean, there's so many ways this could get played.
Enjoy the next 3 weeks.
Yeah, just let us know if we get enough support saying, you know, we want to hear it, then we'll cover it. But at this point, I think we're all kind of a little gun shy. So
it's true. Yeah.
I'm emotionally shy.
But to just in the interest of full disclosure here, I personally am concerned about rewatching it just in terms of emotional state, but I'm willing to do so because aside from any emotional journey, I was so impressed by the power of the story told that I think that it might be worth personally revisiting one more time. Yeah. I know it's going to be rough, but I might consider it worth it. So that's me. Julie, where do you stand on this?
From what I remember, I don't think I want to watch it ever again, emotionally, especially at the end of the year we've had.
Yeah. Valid.
So I can't say that in another 6 months after things are less cooped up, etc., that it might be a little bit better feeling. Mm-hmm. But I don't. So if you choose to watch this and I'm not here, don't. It's not you, it's me.
Yeah, I don't. I've always said that I think that the Children of Earth miniseries are some of the most realistic television out there. Like, it is a very realistic take on a very unrealistic situation. Mm-hmm. And for that reason, it is difficult to watch and get through. But that is exactly the reason why I kind of want to go back and try and pick it apart, because it is very well done and very thought-provoking and very difficult.
So you're thinking there may be some merit to going at it with a more surgical eye, you know, really trying to, all right, I want to take apart what makes certain things work rather than just taking it in as absorb the story. Oh, it's a story.
Yeah. And I'm not saying I won't try at all. If this is the way we go with it, I might, but I don't know if
I will. I will tweet the timestamp on day one about where Julie throws up her hands and goes, "Nope, I'm all aboard the nope train." Bye.
I'm just.
Who was under 2 minutes? Who was
you? Yeah, that could also be. We can have a little bet going on. We'll see if I get through someone we know in it. That might be the time. I'm like, oh hey, yeah, that's right. Yeah. Okay, cool. Bye.
Where's our Frobisher timestamp? And there we're good. Okay. Bing, done. Bing.
Yeah, so I don't know. We'll see how this plays out.
Yeah.
Alright.
Speaking of Russell T. Davies.
Happy birthday. Are we doing
that? He has not figured out how to halt time in all of his command of time and space. Time rolls over him like every other meatbag. I say that in the most loving way. I think he would love being referred to as a lovable meatbag.
Wait, would you like to be referred to as a lovable meatbag?
If Russell T. Davies came up and said, you're a lovable meatbag, I'd give him a big warm hug.
I would only accept it if it was voiced as HK-47 from Knights of the Old Republic. But
okay, fair. Wow, what a pull.
And yes. Jenna Coleman, who shares the same birthday Coleman,
very, very much so. I'm telling you, we kept talking about April being like a big Whovian birthday month. There are just tons of cast and crew birthdays through this month. And a lot of them, as is often the case with Doctor Who, because when you have that many actors over the course of the decades, you've got a lot of shared birthdays. But this was a fun one. I don't think they ever got to collaborate together on anything.
I saw a photo of them together at some point, though. So
yes, yeah, they've probably been at some good appearances and such. Yeah. But even in the projects they've had since, and they're both really, really busy. Like Davies has these phenomenal award-winning series out there. Coleman is working in more series than I think she has time in the day to do. But hey, amphetamines, right?
No statements about amphetamines or otherwise.
I think there's cloning. She's tapping into the whole Clara thing.
I think it's more likely that she's got a time turner.
Yeah, probably the case.
Yeah, it's called a TARDIS.
But yeah, so Davies turns 58 today as we're recording. Jenna turns a paltry 35.
Cool.
Well, Big Finish has been around for a little bit too.
Yeah.
And they've put out a fair number of audio dramas.
Just a few. Enough to earn themselves, an accolade or two.
Right. One big one, I think.
Yeah. Well, I've wondered about the whole Guinness World Record thing before for certain titles that they give away.
You have to make a case for it yourself and then go, we can do that, and then you have to do the thing, and they send in judges.
Mm-hmm.
And the judges say, yes, you've done that thing.
Okay. So some of them, when you see them, you see the news feed go by and there's something about a record that's given for the most pencil eraser tips that have been stuck on the end of other eraser tips. No one else has stuck this many pencil eraser tips on the end of a pencil before. And like, wow, that's impressive, but why?
To get in the book.
Right. Got that. This one, though, I think is a little bit more qualified because it's a matter of broadcast history.
Right. True. The ones that beat out the previous ones are the better Guinness Book of World Record entries, in my opinion, which this, I believe, would have been.
Yeah. So if it's longest running, the record that they have been given, and this happens after an anniversary year for them, they have the longest running science fiction audio play series. But I understand that there are a number of things that fall under that header. Because you think, well, how many science fiction audio play series are there? But it also has to do with radio programs, recorded and released material. There's a number of things that can fall under that umbrella. So the fact that they have been able to do it without a break since 1999. I mean, we talk all the time about the fact that we can't keep up. There's not enough time in the day to listen to all the stuff that they record over the course of a day.
It's true.
I don't know how it works. They record more than there is time in the day. So
again, when you have a TARDIS, you've got all the time in the world to do any recording and editing that you want.
Curse you, Nick Briggs.
He also has Dalek tech that he can tap into.
He is the Dalek time controller.
And that all makes sense hundreds now. Of Daleks. I mean, if you... Yeah. Anyway, yeah. So good job on you mates for giving content like it's your job.
Wait a minute. It is.
Oh.
Oh. Funny that. Well, next week, our classic rewatch returns back into the first season of The Fifth Doctor with the story Kinda.
Right.
Paradise isn't all it's cracked up to be, I guess you could say. And maybe we will find out why Nyssa fainted at the end of Fort of Doomsday. Or maybe we won't. You know.
Well, this has been episode 424 of Gallifrey Public Radio. Until next week, this is Jay saying, I love you, all of you, and I hope I did good.
Oh. And this is Kira saying, make sure that you clean out Owen's browser history before putting that file to bed.
This is Julie saying, someone blew up my model of Cardiff. What?
It's only a model.
We'll see you next week.
I will see.
Bye.
Thanks for joining us for another episode of Gallifrey Public Radio. Want to keep the conversation going? You can find us on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, and YouTube. Or just send us a good old-fashioned email to feedback@gallifreypublicradio.com. You can also give us a phone call at 754-225-5477. That's 754-CALL-GPR, and you may hear your voice on a future episode of the show. Everything's got to end sometime, otherwise nothing would ever get started. Join us next week for a brand new episode.
Jacob Hansen. Gallifrey Public Radio is copyright 2021. We'll see you next week.